The World Travel and Dining Guide with Chef Michael Glotz is now on the air. Chef Michael is a lifetime chef, CIA graduate, restaurateur, world traveler, and radio TV host. Sit back, relax, and listen to Chef Michael take you on a journey to great restaurants and travel destinations and some super culinary tips. And now, here is Chef Michael Glotz.
Hello, you're listening to World Travel and Dining with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining channel. Culinary destinations around the globe or around the corner, as well as some cooking and entertaining tips, too. Thanks for joining me, and please reach out. I'd love to hear from you. The email is chefmichael@foodspacemedia.com. Let's have a drink. Well, you know, the show is broadcast through the GAB satellite, 7 to 9 a.m. on Saturday mornings, so it may seem a little odd to have a drink at this hour of the morning, but I always say it's noon somewhere in the world, and it's certainly we can talk about it. Two of my favorite summertime drinks. We're going to start with sangria. I just love sangria. Sangria can take on so many ways, shapes, and forms, and I've had, and it's a drink that some you can kind of not get on the mark either. I've had some sangrias that are like too sweet, too much cinnamon in them, and different things like that. Let's start with the classic sangria, and to me, it's part of what I preach all the time about cooking. Learn the basics, you know, learn methods and techniques, and then go from there. Once you've really learned what a great sangria is all about, now you can make it your own. Right, by adding little subtle flavors here and there without taking it too far in a different direction. So, of course, sangria, its name comes from sangre, which is the Spanish word for blood, probably because of its color, right? It's got that beautiful, deep, rich red color, and whatever fruits you sort of put in it all kind of turn that rich red color as if they've kind of, the wine has been bleeding into the fruit a little bit. I'm assuming that's kind of where the name comes from. It's kind of fun. And, of course, it comes from sort of the Spain and Portugal part of the world. And it's really just, what is it? It's just a delicious wine punch, really, in its very simplest form. And it's really fairly new here in the U.S. You know, there's writings about it perhaps being in the country here as early as the 1800s. But it never really gained popularity until the 1964 World's Fair in New York. The rest is history after that. Now we just love sangria. We're a country that loves sangria. And it's a perfect drink in the summertime, no matter what you're eating, even if it's not paella. Although I could put down a whole pitcher of sangria with a great paella. That's a perfect combination. So how do you make sangria at home? Start by making it at home, and then you'll realize when you go to restaurants and things, you ask for their sangrias, and they'll start giving you some different ideas of how to build it. Now, a classic sangria would always be made from red wine. And the way this sort of all got started is over 2,000 years ago when the Romans were making their way across the Iberian Peninsula. This was a time in the world where you didn't drink the water because it was really unhealthy and could make you sick or worse. And you didn't really drink the wine either because it was pretty mediocre or sometimes just downright awful. So people were stuck. Oftentimes they would add alcohol to their water to kill the bacteria and things in the water to make the water drinkable, right? And but the alcohol wasn't very tasty, so oftentimes they would add fruits or herbs to the alcohol to make that more palatable. So you had this blending going on. It was probably some of the first punches in the world, right, were made in this way. I'm thirsty. I can't drink the water. I really don't want to drink that wine over there because it's really horrible. Oh, let's mix the two together and add some fresh herbs and some squeeze some fruit into it, and maybe we can make this thing sort of drinkable. How lucky are we that we live in a day and age where we can open up the tap and drink some great water, of course, plenty of bottled waters out there, and great wines and spirits available to us really at our fingertips whenever we want. We have to sort of put ourselves back to what the world must have been like 2,000 years ago and maybe sipping on the first sangria. So the whole idea was to take red wine and adulterate it a little bit in a good way. And so now we've evolved to today where we take red wine and start with good red wine. I don't mean expensive. I mean tasty, right? Because if you take a bottle of red wine that you don't want to drink, oh, so I'll turn it into sangria, you're not going to want to drink it when it's sangria either, right? I never cook or work with any wine that I wouldn't sip out of a glass. That's my rule. And make that your house rule too, right? It can still be inexpensive. Just make sure it's tasty. And of course, if I'm making sangria, I want to start with a Rioja or Ribera del Duero or a nice Toro, something from Spain, just to keep my sangria a little bit more authentic. But you can really start with any great fruity wine. Think fruity red wine. That's where you sort of want to go with this, because you want to accentuate the fruitiness of the sangria, right? So have your bottle of red wine, and I just do some simple citrus. I like lemon, lime, orange, very simply, right? And I cut my fruits up in sort of little wedges, and you can muddle your fruits or not muddle your fruits. I usually take the fruits and put them in a vessel, whatever I'm going to make the sangria in, and I take a wooden spoon or something, and I kind of bang the fruit around a little bit, kind of up and down, chopping the fruit. That releases some of the natural oils in the citrus, right, to help make it a tastier sangria. A little Spanish brandy, always. To a bottle of wine, oh, I would add maybe about a quarter of a cup of Spanish brandy. You can use cognac or brandy, really, from anywhere in the world would be fine. Don't have any brandy, throw a little bourbon in there, throw a little rum in there, right? You're going to make the sangria be your own. I like to add also about a half a cup of something like Cointreau or Grand Marnier. Cointreau a little bit more because it's a little fruitier, right? So I've got my three citrus in there, a little bit of Cointreau, a little bit of cognac, my fruit's a little muddled, pour in a bottle of wine. Make it just before you drink it, maybe an hour or two. Put it in the refrigerator, let the flavors develop. It's better sort of fresh than it is to make it the day before. Although, who doesn't love sangria leftovers? But if you're with me, there aren't going to be any sangria leftovers. There you go. If you're just joining me, you're listening to World Travel and Dining with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining channel on the Global American Broadcasting Network. One of the many ways you can listen is on Saturday mornings from 7 to 9 a.m. on the web. Go to gabsatellite.com. One of my other favorite drinks is a rum punch. And I lived a good part of my adult life in the Caribbean, so I know my rum punch. And I love rum punch. I'm kind of fussy about it. Once again, just like sangria, start with good quality ingredients, right? If you buy cheap, lousy rum that you wouldn't drink out of a glass, don't think it's going to make a great rum punch, because it's not. If you buy sticky, sweet kids' juices in the supermarket that you wouldn't pour into a glass and drink, don't mix them with your rum. It's not going to be a great rum punch, right? I like to start out with good rum. The better the rum, the better. The better quality, the better it's going to taste, right? So use white rum. You don't use barrel-aged rums and so on. Those are for sipping later on. But use a nice white rum. I also love some of the flavored rums. Coconut rum is one of my favorite rums to make rum punch with, because coconut is a hard flavor to infuse into the rum punch. If you start with a coconut rum, you're already in the driver's seat. Now think tropical fruit juices. Think about things like pineapple juice, mango, passion fruit. These are flavors that are really going to take you away. You're going to be sitting in your yard, sipping on this rum punch, feeling like you're somewhere in the islands, right? Think tropical fruits, very, very important. Avoid things like orange juice, cranberry juice, or these juice cocktail blends that have raspberry, strawberry, carrot, and all that. Those are all fun things, and it'll be a tasty rum juice drink, but I'm trying to get you to have a sort of a tropical rum punch. Because when I sip rum punch, that's what I want to be on vacation, right? So think about things like parcha or passion fruit, mango juice. I also like to squeeze some fresh lime in there, because sometimes these juices that you buy can be a little on the sweet side. If you squeeze a little fresh lime in there, it kind of brightens it up, gives it a little bit more acidity, and takes away the sort of heavy sweetness that the juices can have. And forget about the heavy dose of rum floater on the top, okay? You're not 21 anymore. And you want to be able to have a couple of rum punches. Excuse me. So if you put some of that rum floater on top, it's more for the buzz, and it's gonna take away your ability to enjoy a couple of rum punches, right? You're outside, you're the summertime, take it slowly, right? A little bit of rum, some great tropical juices, and away you go. Remember that little squeeze of lime, and start out with a good flavored rum. There's also some wonderful fruit-flavored rums. And again, I would stay away from silly things like strawberry rum or orange rum. I would lean towards mango rum, coconut rum, pineapple rum, parcha. Parcha is also the Spanish word for passion fruit. So a lot of times these things like rums, they won't say passion fruit on the label. They may say parcha. It's the same thing. Really delicious. Bright tropical flavors. Set the hammock outside. Make yourself a rum punch. Leave the cell phone in the house. Go outside. Enjoy a nice summer afternoon. Because that's what summer's all about, right? You're listening to The World Travel and Dining with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining channel on the Global American Broadcasting Network, streaming 7 to 9 a.m. Saturday mornings on the Gab One app on your mobile device. I'd love to hear from you, Chef Michael at foodspacemedia.com. everyone, and welcome. You're listening to Culinary Travel Destinations with Chef Michael on the World Travel and Dining Channel over the Global American Broadcasting Network. Want to be a guest on my show and share your favorite food destination with the world? My email address is chefmichael@foodspacemedia.com. With me today is the mother and daughter travel team of Christina and Jenna DeFalco. Welcome to the show, ladies.
Thank you, Chef.
Thank you, Chef.
Nice to have you both here. You recently traveled from your home in Vero Beach, Florida, to Europe.
We did.
And I guess you landed in Italy, but your ultimate destination was Switzerland.
Yes. The ultimate destination was Lugano, actually.
Okay.
Lake Lugano.
Great.
It was beautiful.
Beautiful.
We had a wonderful time.
And why did you go to Lake Lugano? There was a special reason.
Well, our daughter, Lauren, who is 21, was accepted to work at TASIS, which is the American school in Switzerland, right in Montagnola, which is in the hills of Lugano. So that's where we left Lauren. Jenna and I, we traveled together with Lauren for 2 weeks, and then we left Lauren in Lugano working in Montagnola, which is absolutely breathtaking. So she'll be a counselor there until the end of August.
Oh, great. We'll have to hear about her trip when she gets back.
Yes.
So that's perfect. So this is the American School in Switzerland, and you can find it on the web at switzerland.tasis.com.
Yes, it was founded in the 50s, actually.
Wow, 19th, fascinating.
Yes. And the founder wanted, which is interesting that you do this beautiful food-centric show, the founder had an idea of education through travel. That's really what the basis for a TASIS is, where American children would be exposed to European culture and food and people and history.
That's fabulous. Well, let's rewind back to the beginning of your trip. And so you landed in, where'd you land, Jenna?
We landed in Milan.
In Milan.
Yes.
How beautiful.
And that was the basis for our trip. We were staying in Milan, and we were planning to make our day trips from Milan and have that be our central base.
So that was home base for how many days?
We were there for a week.
Yes.
Oh, great.
For 1 week. And we decided, Jenna and I and Lauren decided that we were going to really be with people. So no taxis and no chauffeur-driven limousines. We were going to do the subway, the metro.
No chauffeur-driven limousines. I'm not traveling with you.
No, I really wanted
them.
No,
that's the way to do it.
Yes, I really wanted them to get the feel. Did you get the feel?
Yes,
the
true experience. And every trip with buses and trains, we met so many wonderful people.
Now, Jenna, you're world traveled, right? You've been all over Europe at this point, right?
No, this was my very first European
That's
trip.
Really awesome.
So I was so excited to be with my mom and sister. It was a great girls trip, and we really were so exposed and really did meet some amazing people. And sometimes it was because we were asking for confirmation with our direction, and sometimes we were just sought out and really met some wonderful people who told us wonderful stories and hearing where they're from and where they've traveled.
That's
and
great.
It was great.
I think it's the best way when you travel, and I always encourage people when they dine and they travel, stay away from the tourist traps.
Yes.
Don't go to the restaurants and the big hotels. Dine where the locals eat. Dine where the locals go out on a Saturday night, and you're taking it to the next level. You're taking the bus with the locals, and you're meeting them on the street, and that's so perfect. The Milan has a great tourist website. It is tourism.milan.it. So check that out, and you'll get some great suggestions, but I'm sure you'll give me some great suggestions. So if I was going to Milan tonight, where would I go have dinner?
Or
at least tell us some of the great food you had.
Well, we stayed at the Hotel Fenice right in the center of Milan, which was great. It was a metro ride away to the Duomo, Il Duomo, which was right in the center of town, and La Scala. So we really did see the very historic spots, but Jenna had a wonderful meal. Well, we all did, but Jenna had that night that we were in that restaurant right in Milan, right in the center of the city. Jenna looked at the menu and she said, I'm going to have that spaghetti a la carbonara. She couldn't wait to have it.
And craving it.
Right? She was craving it. We call that in Italian an aquilina. She had this yen for carbonara.
Yes, exactly.
And you know what was exciting for us is that for me, this was a dream come true to take the girls on the European trip, their first time, because we are Italian Americans. We are Italo-Americani and wanted to get them to their roots. My family and my husband's family are from southern Italy, from Avellino, near right outside of Naples. So we decided that this was going to be our inaugural trip to get Lauren to Lugano, and I was going to do a little bit of the north, and then our next trip, we're going to go down south.
Great. I need to dive into that plate of carbonara. Tell me about it.
Oh, my goodness. It was so delicious.
Different cured meats and cheeses. And I can make carbonara at home, and I do often, and I'm sure you do as well, but nothing like sitting in Milan having it.
Yes, and we sat outside, and the atmosphere was just amazing. You spoke about how it's important to find where the locals dine, and that was definitely a spot where we found a lot of locals, so that made it more real, and our waiter was so wonderful, and of course, it was great that he came over speaking Italian to us. We were saying, yes, you know, they thought we were locals, so that was great. And but my mom won't admit it, but she is wonderful with her Italian and definitely got us through the trip, and it was so amazing to see her speak the language, and she got a lot of compliments. That was great.
Christina, you've been to Italy often, or
many times, yes, and it's a place that I love to go back to. I have to say proudly, I've traveled all over the world, and Italy for me, being there where my family is from, was just so special.
Sure.
But talking about eating, this night we had carbonara. We also had pesto, and you know, the northern kitchen is known for its polenta and its risotto and pesto and its minestrone, the vegetable soups.
Oh,
very
I'm
hearty.
Hungry. Excuse me while I wipe drool off my face here.
And
my
I
goodness.
Know, Chef, you are. We're going to have a little celebration after this. We also had beautiful bolognese, which was absolutely beautiful. The prosciutto, crudo and cotto were absolutely delicious. We also sampled some speck because we're in the north. So, you know, the speck comes from, you know, the other countries are using speck too.
Right,
Germany, Switzerland, Austria.
Speck.
Yes, speck is just so delicious. But the carbonara had this beautiful prosciutto and pancetta and beautiful cream, and it was just absolutely
so even
beautiful.
If you're Italian American like yourself and you cook for your family all the time and you cook Italian food, it's still, to me, it's just not the same as when you're there.
No.
Right? Mm-hmm. Because first of all, the ingredients are really Italian. I mean, they're authentically Italian.
And fresh.
And
so
fresh. And you're there. And there's just something about it when I traveled that I go home and I duplicate dishes I've had while I was away. And it's like, it's delicious. And it's a wonderful memory for me. But it isn't quite the same, you know, as having it there.
Well, we were taking pictures of beautiful monuments. But what else did we take pictures of? And what other stores did we go into? We went into all the Sala Marias, and we went into the fruit markets.
Yes.
Tell Chef Michael about that beautiful piece of fruit that you had that you absolutely, you said, that's the one I want.
Yes, beautiful nectarines, and we had figs and from the fresh markets, and it was just, it was such a treat.
Delectable.
Right. Yes.
Different than going to the supermarket here, right?
But
there
yes.
you're right in the market.
Oh, my goodness.
And you know it was picked off that tree that day.
Exactly.
And hand-picked for you. Meaning the attendants in the supermarket, you're not allowed to touch the fruit.
Yep.
They touch it for you. You know, it's so cared for. The figs we ate were the size of golf balls.
Wow.
I mean, just absolutely beautiful. Right. And, you know, you go to your fruit market and you buy your fruit and you eat it right there in the street, or you take it home and you put a little prosciutto with your melone and you have a...
And food is simpler because
very
it's
simple.
So fresh. You don't need a lot of ingredients. You just use really good fresh ingredients and keep it simple.
Yeah, and it's not thought of in any other way because it's all so fresh. There isn't. We were very surprised to see McDonald's.
Yeah.
In Lake Como. We were very surprised.
You didn't go. Tell me you didn't go.
No, we promised.
Oh, it breaks my heart.
But it was absolutely wonderful.
We get a little bit of their cuisine through eating fresh figs with prosciutto and wonderful risottos, and they're eating our cuisine by stopping at McDonald's.
Yeah. The risotto that we had was absolutely beautiful. It was a lovely, lovely dish. We had one dish, risotto was with asparagus.
Asparagus,
wow.
Yes.
And then we also had a risotto with mushrooms, with fungi. I mean, absolutely.
Well, we're going to have you back on a future show because I'm sure there's so much more to talk about. And we didn't even get a chance to go to Switzerland yet. So I promise you we'll have you back on a future show. Thank you both, Christina and Jenna, for sharing your travel story with us today. Keep in touch and let me know where your culinary adventures take you next. You're listening to Culinary Destinations with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining Channel over the Global American Broadcasting Network. I want to hear from you. My email is chefmichael@foodspacemedia.com. Hello, you're listening to World Travel and Dining with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining channel on the Global American Broadcasting Network. If you'd like to be a guest on my show, want to tell me about a great culinary destination, I'd love to hear from you. Reach out to me by writing chefmichael@foodspacemedia.com. Speaking of writing out to me, we have a couple of emails that came in over the course of the week from some folks that have listening in and starting to send in some questions. It's really great. I appreciate everyone that listens and shouts out to me. It's always great to hear from you. Remember, if you are writing in to me at chefmichael@foodspacemedia.com, try to tell me where you live and how you hear the show, because there's different ways. People are hearing it on local radio. Some people are streaming it live over the internet. Other folks on their mobile devices. Different ways to listen. So let's see what we got here today. The first email comes from Cindy. She's from Thomasville, Georgia, and she loves the World Travel and Dining Show, which she streams, directly from the website, WTDRadio.com, World Travel and Dining Radio. So that's WTDRadio.com. That's how she listens on Saturday mornings from 7 to 9. You can click on the Gab 1 Listen Now little icon on the top of the website, and that will allow you to stream the show live. And she wants to know, what's my go-to meal to cook at home? Like, what's my favorite thing to do? And that's a tough one, Cindy, because, you know, as a chef, I don't really sort of have a favorite go-to meal. And people oftentimes will say, oh, this is your last meal. What's your last request? What would you eat? You know, and that's a tough one, because my last meal today or my go-to meal today might be different tomorrow, might be different on Saturday. Kind of depends on how I feel, what kind of day I've had. You know, that's one of the quirks of being a chef. It isn't as simple as, oh, I love mac and cheese, and that would be my absolute end-all meal. Because that's not true. That might be my end-all meal today. Tomorrow it might be ossobuco. On Saturday it might be some burgers on the grill. So kind of a tough one to answer. What I do is, I've talked about this before on other broadcasts, is just always have a good pantry at home. You know, just really great ingredients to work with. Mostly non-perishable ingredients, and then, you know, some spices and seasonings and condiments and oils and vinegars and so on. And it's easy to kind of go from there. And I tend to shop every day. When I cook at home, I tend to go to the market every day. And guess what? That's what our ancestors did. That's what a lot of people do. If you've had the pleasure of visiting foreign countries and big cities and stuff, and you go to the street markets, right, where the vendors are all there selling their produce. You know, there's meat. There's meat hanging, different things, and people are kind of shopping for their food that day. Well, here we are, more modern America here, and we tend to go to the supermarket. Right. Well, I go to the supermarket almost every day because I'm going to buy what I feel like eating that day. So if I'm sort of thinking I want to grill, I'm going to go to the market. I'm going to go to the proteins and I'm going to see what looks great to go on the grill. Excuse me. Oftentimes I do have that hankering. I want to make a great mac and cheese, or I feel like a nice steak. Or I really feel creative. I want to get some veal shanks and do some ossobuco, but I want to throw a little bit different flair in it. I want to make it sort of Tex-Mex, and I start putting different spices and jalapenos in there, and suddenly I've taken this classic Italian dish and done something very different with it. So there you go, Cindy. That's my simple, what's my go-to meal? The answer is, I don't have one. It depends on the day of the week and when you caught me. I don't know if that helped you or not, but treat your own food the same way. Right. Open up your mind. Open up your palate a little bit. Open up your pantry and just have many different go-to meals. More fun that way. Okay. So Robert from Orlando also streams from the website WTDRadio.com, and he has two questions. First, what do I do in a restaurant ordering some wine? Some people are ordering fish. Some people are ordering meat. And his second question, he's sort of intimidated in a restaurant. What's right and what's wrong? And then what do you do with the cork and the first tasting and all that? So most of us that drink wine at home, that's a good question, Robert, because, you know, we drink wine at home, we just pull the cork out, we start drinking. We don't go through some of the ceremony that happens in a restaurant, right? You order wine in a restaurant, the waiter brings it over, he kind of shows you the bottle, puts it in your face, pulls the cork out, puts it next to you. What am I supposed to do with that? Pours a little bit in your glass and stands there. It's really quite simple. All you're doing is tasting the wine, and it's not about whether you like it or not. You already bought it, okay? So pick a wine that you know you're going to enjoy. It's about making sure there isn't a really obvious, serious flaw in the wine. That very rarely happens. It can happen. It's very, very rare to pull the cork on a bottle of wine and have it be flawed. That's all you're really tasting in a restaurant. They're giving you that little taste. Give it a little swirl, smell it, sip it really quickly. Boom, it's perfect. The other thing you're tasting for is the temperature. sometimes the wine isn't quite cool enough and you want to look at the waiter and say, could you plunge that in an ice bath for me and just drop the temperature a few degrees? Other times the wine is a little bit too cold. So you want them to go ahead and pour it and just leave it right on the table. Don't put it in an ice bucket because the wine is already a perfect temperature. So that's kind of what that ceremony is all about. What does the cork tell you? Honestly, not a whole lot. You know, unless you're drinking older aged Bordeaux and Burgundies and big California cabs and so on, you might look at the cork and be able to tell, you know, how well it was stored and so on. But most of the wine we drink nowadays in restaurants, it's a year, two, three, five at the most old. You're not going to learn a whole lot by the cork. In fact, so many of the wines now have the Stelvin enclosure, that twist cap on it. So they put the cork down in front of you. It's not going to tell you very much. You can smell it. What should it smell like? Cork. Just smell like cork and a little bit of the wine. It's really quite simple. What to do if people are, some people are ordering fish, some are ordering meat? That's a tough one. You know, it's nice if you're with a little bit larger table, you can get a bottle of white and a bottle of red. Maybe you're just with one other guest and they're having fish and you're having meat. Now it becomes a little more challenging, right? So you can go to sort of a middle of the road wine. You can go with a lighter style red, a nice Gamay or a Beaujolais Village that might work with your meat entree and their seafood entree. You can go with a heavier red, a big Chardonnay that might go also. You know, so they're not going to be perfect matches, but it really isn't about a perfect match. You're not having a perfect wine pairing. You're just enjoying a nice dinner out. So relax and realize there's no hard and fast rule. Drink what you like, eat what you like, put the two together, right? Restaurants nowadays have great wine by the glass programs. Oftentimes that ends it right there, especially if there's just two of you dining. It's really easy to have just enjoy some great wines by the glass without ordering a bottle. That kind of takes the mystery away a little bit. Sometimes what I like to do, I tend to be a person that enjoys a little white wine with my appetizer and a little red wine. I tend to eat a lot of meat, so I enjoy a red wine with my entree. So you could order a bottle of white wine that you share with the appetizer, and then that might be a wine that they sip through with their fish dish while you're drinking some red with your entree. So different ways you can kind of work that out. The best thing is a great wine by the glass program, or if you're with a larger group, order a couple bottles of white, couple bottles of red, put them in the center of the table, and have some fun. There's really no right way or no wrong way. Next up, we have Roberto from Miami. And Roberto has the Gab One app on his phone. You can download that through Play Store or the iTunes Store. He loves a lot of several of the different shows on the Global American Broadcasting Network. So he actually has the app right on his phone. And he heard my show last week for the first time. He's going to Chicago in the fall and wondering what my favorite restaurants are there. Well, here's one for you, Roberto. I've never been to Chicago, so I can't answer that question for you that easily. But here's what you can do. Here's some of my favorite places to go on the internet when I'm traveling to a city I've never been, and I want to make it a culinary destination. If you've ever heard of the James Beard Awards, they happened recently in New York. The James Beard Awards are sort of the Oscars of the restaurant business. And go to their website, jamesbeard.com, and there you can see different restaurants that have been nominated for awards or have participated, right? And you can find things in the city that's your destination. Another great place to go is Zagat.com. In this case, Roberto, go to Zagat.com/Chicago, and you'll see some of the highest rated restaurants in Chicago on the Zagat website. Of course, there's TripAdvisor, right? That's, you know, up to the sort of the whims of people writing reviews, so be a little careful there. When you go to TripAdvisor, read lots of reviews, right? These are written by sort of, you know, non-professionals. People are sort of foodies, but the reviews can be swayed in either way, so be a little careful there. Also, OpenTable.com. It's a wonderful reservation system, but they also have ratings within the system. So you can sort of see, go to OpenTable.com/Chicago, see what restaurants are there in Chicago. On OpenTable, they're broken down by category, steakhouses, fine dining, Asian, pizza. You know, so there's some great ways you can sort of see different restaurants, read some quick reviews on them, and find out what's going on in Chicago in the food scene. So there you go. Great, great, great questions. Love hearing from you all. So if you have cooking, entertaining questions, wine questions, food questions, cheese questions, travel destination questions, email me at chefmichael@foodspacemedia.com. You're listening to the World Travel and Dining Show with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining Channel on the Global American Broadcasting Network. Welcome to The Farmhouse with Chef Michael on the World Travel and Dining Channel over the Global American Broadcasting Network. Listen weekly Saturday mornings from 7 to 9 a.m. on your mobile device. Go to the Play Store or iTunes and download your Gab One app today. If you'd like to tell me about a great farm in your area, my email is chefmichael@foodspacemedia.com. I'd love to hear from you. A few years back, I found myself in Vermont, and I'd gone up there for a restaurant project and had a little time left on my hands, and I wasn't quite so busy, and I thought, you know, here I am in Vermont, and I need to keep busy, and what will I do? Should I go search out another restaurant that needs a little help? Or I thought, I'm in the heart of artisan cheese country in southern Vermont. And I thought, it just couldn't get any better than this. I'm a cheesehead. I'm a very cheese-centric person. I love cheese. I've taken classes on cheeses. I visited lots of farms. And so I thought, let's just see if I can get a job really learning how to make cheese down and dirty the way they do it in Vermont on the farm. And so I reached out and sent out my resume and some emails to some of the local farmers and heard, of course, nothing back. You know, if you've got a farmer that has time to be answering his emails and reviewing your resume, then he's probably not a successful farmer because he's out in the fields working the animals, working his crops, doing what they do. And so a friend turned me on to a farmer by the name of Mark Fisher. He owns Woodcock Farm in Weston, Vermont. And now we're talking about maybe April. March, April was very early spring, just sort of the start of mud season in Vermont when the snow is melting and the rivers are flowing and everything's running down the mountains and it's pretty muddy. And Mark Fisher at Woodcock Farm raises East Frisian sheep and he makes cheese with their milk. And so our mutual friend said, go see Mark Fisher. I'll bet he could use some help over at the farm, and he'll teach you how to make some cheese. So I got in my car, and I drove out to the farm there in Weston, Vermont, about the center of the state. And I see a guy out on a tractor in the fields. I get down to the end of the dirt road, and I got out of the car, and I walked halfway across the field, and he kind of met me halfway. And he's a farmer. He's busy, you know, by himself on the tractor, probably a little annoyed that I was there. And you know, this guy walking across this field. And I introduced myself and I said, I want to learn how to make cheese. And if I recall correctly, it was a few years ago, I think he just laughed at me. And he said, you want to do what? You want to learn how to make cheese? You know, here I am, a professional chef in my 40s at the time. And you want to learn how to make cheese? He said, look, here's the deal. I'm a busy guy. See that barn over there? There's over 100 ewes in there. They're all pregnant. They're all going to start giving birth soon. See that empty field when you first pulled in and all those boxes laying there? A barn needs to be erected over there because when all those ewes give birth, we have to put their lambs somewhere. You know, I've got all this farmland to take care of, the barn to take care of. You know, I start milking sheep every day. We've got to clean out the barn. We've got to clean out the milking parlor, clean out the cheese house. You know, I don't know. And I probably can't pay you. And I'm not even sure there's time to teach you how to make cheese. But I start my day every day at 5 a.m. And he got on his tractor and he drove away. And of course, I was met with disappointment. I thought, well, I just really wanted to learn how to make cheese. I don't know. I thought I was going to walk into this sterile sort of tiled room and put on some gloves and a hairnet and learn how to make cheese. And I didn't get that at all. I don't know what I got. You know, so I got in my car and I drove back home. It was about an hour away. So I had a lot of time to think. And I thought, he's a farmer. This is Michael's. You're a chef. You're a square ball chef, you know. Everything comes to you through the back door from a purveyor or you go to a market and you get it. This is a farmer. This is where it all starts. You should go there tomorrow at 5 a.m. and see if you can help this guy out. And maybe you won't make any money, but you'll learn how to make some cheese. I know you will. So the next morning, I set my alarm real early and I showed up at 5 a.m. I come down the dark, muddy road, and I see him out there rubbing the sleep out of his eyes, firing up his tractor, or whatever he was doing. And I got out of my car, and he said to me, what are you doing here? And I said, I thought that was a job offer yesterday. I think he was really annoyed with me. He certainly wasn't amused by my being there. I said, you know, I want to help you. I don't know how to make cheese. He said, okay. There's 46 acres of electric fence line that has been damaged from the winter. And you'll find some tools over there in the corner. You ever get shocked by an electric fence? And I said, I don't believe I ever have. And he punches me in the arm. He said, feels like that. Great. He said, so pick up some tools and start over there in the corner. 46 acres, work yourself around. You want to clean any debris off the fence line, sort of make any repairs you need to make. And that's how we'll start our day. Well, I didn't know what to do. I sort of felt like I wanted to get in my car and drive away. It was kind of a frustrating experience. But I grabbed some tools, a saw, some pliers, a few wrenches, and I started working that fence line. I got all the way around the fence line. It took me a couple of days, and I did it. And I pulled up one morning, and I hear baby lambs crying. And in the darkness, I walk into the barn, and there's Mark, the farmer, and he's helping this ewe give birth. And there's lambs everywhere. He must have had quite a night. And I spent the next couple of weeks helping him help these ewes give birth to all these beautiful lambs that are all hungry and making noise, and they all have to be tagged, and they all have to be cared for, and they all have to be fed, and they have to be nursed. And it was just an amazing experience. In between all of this, he and I erected that smaller sort of do-it-yourself kind of barn on an empty lot on his property where we eventually moved all the lambs to. And we cared for them, and we cared for the moms, and we started to clean out the milking parlor because lambs give birth and therefore lactate, and farmers make cheese on a cycle every year, right? It's not like cows where it's just a constant all year round. There's a definite cycle to making sheep's milk cheese. So the milking parlor and the cheese room were all broken down for the winter. They need to be opened up, cleaned up, sanitized, and then the animals needed to be milked. And so my life on the farm began. It was quite an interesting experience. Thanks for spending a little time with me today. You're listening to The Farmhouse with Chef Michael on the World Travel and Dining channel over the Global American Broadcasting Network. What I learned really quickly on the farm is that Mark was a little bit like a scientist with cheese. It was a lot of experimentation, different molds and different bacterias and different ways of handling the milk and different temperatures. And what I really learned about cheese was it isn't as simple as taking some milk and curdling it and packing it into a mold and putting it away somewhere. It may work like that in some places. Think supermarket cheeses and big cheese manufacturers, those sorts of things. But down on the farm, it's really very different. And there's no real exact formula to making cheese. You can start with a certain amount of salt and a certain temperature and a certain bacteria and a certain amount of rennet and so on. But there are so many other things that influence what kind of cheese is going to be the final, you know, the final product that you produce. And Mark, instead of producing clones of cheeses that he just wanted to be sort of cookie cutter like every other cheese, he really creates cheese. And he's constantly tweaking and fine-tuning the little nuances so that he could echo sort of European artisan farmstead cheese making and put his own signature on it. Just fascinating stuff. And he sells his cheeses at local farmers markets. Unfortunately, that's the best place to buy them. So if you're in Vermont, check out the Londonderry Farmers Market on Saturdays. You'll also find his cheeses at the Brattleboro Food Co-op. Online, you can purchase his cheeses at artisanmade-ne.com. That's artisanmade-ne.com. That's an online store for artisan-made cheeses in New England. You'll find his cheeses there. He doesn't have a website because, of course, he's out in the field and working with his animals all the time, but you can visit their page on the Vermont Cheese Council site. Go to vtcheese.com. That's Vermont, vtcheese.com, and you can see Mark Fisher's page there. It was quite an experience working on the farm. Life, death, cheese, animals. As a chef, it really just changed me forever. I'll never forget it, realizing the challenges of a farmer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So by the wheel, by the wedge, or by the pound, think about all the hard work, passion, and love every time you pick up a piece of artisan cheese or really any artisan farm product. You've been listening to The Farmhouse with Chef Michael Glotz on the World Travel and Dining channel over the Global American Broadcasting Network. Need more information? Have comments or questions about today's show? I'd love to hear from you. Email Chef Michael at foodspacemedia.com.